This is Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headlee. Welcome to Super Tuesday. If you are in one of the 15 states holding elections today and you haven't yet, go vote. But while you're grabbing your keys, keep listening because we're going to talk about how we elect the president. In both our presidential primaries and the general election, voters are not actually directly electing the president. You are electing delegates to party conventions and the Electoral College, respectively. The majority of Americans want the Electoral College gone and to put the popular vote in its place. But a new book out today argues there's another way forward, one where we, the people, don't directly vote for the president.
What we really want to do is empower voters. We want to give them meaningful choices. And the system that I propose does just that. It lets them cast two ballots for the House of Representatives in a way that lets them say where they want the coalition to go.
Maxwell Stearns, a law professor and author of Parliamentary America, joins us in just a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back to Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is Super Tuesday. First things first, please go vote if you haven't done so already. The stakes are high, and not just in the presidential contest, but in the smaller races too. Still, today we'll talk about how we choose the occupant of the White House every 4 years. Since the founding of this country, we've had 58 presidential elections, and in five of them, the winner did not get the most votes. John Quincy Adams, Rutherford B. Hayes, Benjamin Harrison, George W. Bush, and Donald Trump. Coincidentally, they were all Republicans, except Adams, who was in office before the GOP was founded. You can lose the popular vote in this country and still win the presidency, because our Constitution demands that each state appoint electors who vote for president, and they may not even be required to vote for the same person that the state's residents chose. The most popular proposal for fixing the Electoral College problem is to get rid of it. A Pew poll from September of last year found 65% of Americans say the president should be the person who got the most votes. That would, of course, require a constitutional amendment, a two-thirds vote in both houses of Congress, and approval from two-thirds of the 50 states. Our guest today wants to go in the opposite direction. He says maybe the best way to elect a president is by not having citizens involved at all. Joining us is Maxwell Stearns, a professor of law at the University of Maryland and the author of Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. It's a book that hit shelves today. So I should say first, congratulations, Maxwell.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you for having me on your show.
So for those who don't know you or your work, tell us what you do.
So I am a law professor. I teach at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. I teach constitutional law, and I also teach economic analysis of law. So if I may, I do want to just issue a small correction to something you said. I would not say that what I'm proposing removes citizens from the process. In fact, I believe that what I'm proposing empowers citizens to have greater influence in the direction of the appointment of the government, including how a coalition government forms. What I am proposing is that they accomplish that not by directly voting for president, but rather through a process of parliamentary selection of the head of government, which also includes increasing, but not too much, the number of parties so that voters have more meaningful choices.
So, I mean, yes, you're not the only political scientist or expert who said that a parliamentary system, which is essentially what you're proposing, would increase the power that citizens have. But this suggestion does mean we as citizens wouldn't be voting for president every 4 years.
That is correct. And yeah. That is how business is done in thriving democracies across the globe. And those systems generally give voters greater influence in terms of who they really want to head the government because they have more choices, but also the direction they want the government to form because those governments are not operated under a winner-take-all system. Instead, they operate based on coalitions that form typically in the lower legislative chamber, which for us would be the House of Representatives.
So I want to go back. There is so much to talk about here. But let me start with what we know about the reason for this rule. In other words, why the authors, the framers of the Constitution, created the Electoral College. And as far as we know, from what they themselves wrote, they were really worried that partisanship would outweigh the rights of citizens. They intentionally tried to get in the way of party control by creating this complicated system of checks and balances, right? I mean, the same party that runs Congress may not, well, runs the House of Representatives or controls it, may not control the Senate, may not control the presidency. But under a parliamentary system, that's not the case. So wouldn't this suggestion sort of undermine the very structure of our government?
It would certainly change some key institutional features of our government, but it would also respectfully retain a surprising number of features of our system. I'm not looking to displace our Constitution. I'm looking to fix it, to amend the Constitution so that the government's more responsive, so that voters are happier and more satisfied with the options that they have before them, and so that we're not continuously running against a genuine crisis threatening our democracy. So I do want to go back to your comment about the framers, and specifically James Madison, who really was the primary architect of the Constitution. And if you go back to your time in school, middle school perhaps, or high school, and you think about the stories that you were told, that the framers of the Constitution set up a never-ending set of rival jealousies across the three branches of government, Congress, the presidency or executive branch, and the judiciary or the Supreme Court. They convey a notion that in the book I describe as a kind of rock, paper, scissors game where every option can defeat every other option. And it's really also like scissors, paper, rock. Every option can also be defeated by every other option. And they really believed that setting up these checks and balances or rivalries across the three branches of government, and then you throw in federalism on top of that, so you've got geographical rivalries, was going to break and control what they called the violence of factions, which is what you were also referring to. And you could think of factions as precursors to modern political parties. But there's a fundamental tension in the constitutional system, which is what you also alluded to. By setting up a system in which to win the presidency, you must win a majority of the Electoral College, that produces and did from the beginning, from the earliest parts of our history, an overwhelming tendency toward a two-party presidential system. Because the intuition is that in order to win that majority in the Electoral College, you want to fracture the opposition, but you never want to fracture your side. And with both sides achieving those incentives, we end up with two dominant parties, and we end up with the danger that we're realizing in the information age, that because these margins between the two parties are fairly close, you can't afford to relinquish any part of your coalition, because if you do, fracturing your side, you risk throwing control to the other side. And what we've seen since the beginning of the information age, the early 1990s, is that the modes or centers of our two parties are growing further and further apart. And that has led to profound dysfunction. And so the idea is what we really want to do is empower voters. We want to give them meaningful choices. And the system that I propose does just that. It lets them cast two ballots for the House of Representatives in a way that lets them say where they want the coalition to go.
Okay, I want to jump in here because a lot of political scientists agree with you that the only way to break the two-party rule in this country, which I don't think, I'm not an expert, but I don't think that's what the framers of the Constitution or James Madison wanted, would be some kind of parliamentary system. I mean, a quick, for our listeners, Duverger's law says that if you have a political system where winner takes all, there's only one winner, then two main parties are going to emerge. And if you do have smaller parties, they'll just steal votes from those two main parties. Okay, so yes, the partisan system in this country, I agree. We agree on this. It's toxic. And we have to find some way to break the power of these two parties. On the other hand, just to go back to that idea of the separation of powers, this was set up, this balance, so that the president needs Congress in order to pass his or her, so far, his bills. Congress needs the president in order to get their bills signed into law. And then the Supreme Court can declare those laws unconstitutional. Isn't most of our political system in this country based on that delicate balance, which may not be a balance at this point? I think the Supreme Court is kind of overruling everything, but wouldn't that undermine pretty much everything we know about the way our government works, our Congress, our the executive office?
So there's a lot to unpack there, and I'll sort of take it piece by piece, if I may. I don't think it would undermine the objectives of the framers. I think it would further the objectives of the framers, because the framers made a mistake of setting up a system that was fundamentally at odds with what they thought was going to happen. And this isn't a recent development. I mean, you can go back to George Washington's farewell address, and he recognized that the way the system was supposed to work even then scarcely resembled the way it actually worked. So what Madison wanted and what Madison created are two different things. And the question is how to achieve what he wanted, not what he created, which undermines what he wanted. A little note on Duverger's law. Duverger's law doesn't really apply to the U.S. Duverger's law envisions, what Duverger envisioned was a single election in which you would have what amounts to winner take all. We have a two-staged election, primary followed by a general election. So it's not quite Duverger's law. I talk about it in my book and
he
explain.
He was French, yeah.
And, well, yeah, he was, and very thoughtful, but the system he's describing just isn't the one that we have. And you're right about what I call in the book the third-party dilemma, which is that every 4 years we're admonished not to vote for a third party because they operate either as, and people are familiar with this term, spoilers. You vote for somebody to the left of the Democrat or right of the Republican, and you end up supporting the major party candidate you least prefer. But also you run the risk of what I refer to in the book as randomizers, those candidates who draw in votes from both sides, rendering the outcome a roll of the dice. But the real heart of your question has to do with executive accountability and with ensuring that the executive really is serving the interests of the people. And the problem with the two-party system, going back to what I said moments ago, is that neither side can give up any of its coalition. And so there has been this tragic tendency to succumb to the most overwhelming demands of base voters or the party leader. And in fact, one of the ironies is that we end up with much greater checks and balances, much greater executive accountability if we have the lower legislative chamber through coalition negotiations choosing the head of the government for one very important reason. At that point, if the president does something that really warrants removal, and I have a mechanism for that, a vote of no confidence for maladministration, there are other actors and other parties that can come into the coalition. And there are other means by which we can have a functional government that's not dependent on what has turned into, tragically, in some instances, a cult of personality, which is exactly the opposite of what the framers of the Constitution wanted, but actually created a mechanism that rendered it tragically possible.
We're going to have to take a break here because there's so much to dig in here. And, you know, so I think one of the difficulties anytime we talk about these truly crucial issues is that they can come off sounding like an academic argument, and they really are not. I think there's one thing you and I both could agree on, it's that at this point our democracy is in crisis, and these conversations are important. So, that said, I hope our listeners will stay with us because there's a lot more to say. This is Hear Me Out, and we will be right back. We're back. This is Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate, and I'm talking about how we elect the president, mostly because Maxwell Stearns, a professor of law, has written a book that it says a lot of stuff, but one of the things it says is that citizens shouldn't vote for the president every 4 years, but instead we should have more of a parliamentary system where they choose who leads the party and who becomes president. Because we're mentioning other parliaments or other parliamentary systems, I have to point out how dysfunctional some of the other parliamentary governments in the world are, right? Spain has, since 2008, has had 5 national elections. At one point, they failed to form a government for over 300 days. I think that was 2016. Italy had 3 national elections. One government failed. It was replaced by a different coalition without any election occurring. Germany held 4 elections. Now, that's about, it was every 4 years, so that's the same as the U.S., but it took months and months for them to form coalitions, 5-month period in 2017. So, you know, earlier on you mentioned healthy parliamentary systems. Is that actually healthy? Is that what we're supposed to be modeling ourselves on?
No, and in fact, the point of the book is to demonstrate that we don't want to model ourselves on the systems that you describe. So what I do in this book, the centerpiece of the book, is that I take readers on a virtual world tour to 7 countries, and we learn a lot of lessons about other countries along the way. The countries that I'll tour you, and I'm a good tour guide, are England, France, Germany, Israel, Taiwan, Brazil, and Venezuela. And what I demonstrate is that democracies confront choices on 2 axes. They have to choose how to elect their lower legislative chamber, and they have to determine how they select the head of government and how they hold that person accountable. So there are twin threats to a democracy. One threat is having too few parties, majoritarian systems like the US, like the UK, think Brexit. The opposite threat is having too many parties, think Brazil, think Italy, think Israel, think Spain, think other countries that have fragmented parties. But there is a system, and political scientists generally agree it is the best system because it achieves the political Goldilocks principle. The goal is to have more parties, but not too many more parties. And so the goal is to have roughly between 4 and 8 parties. And the system to achieve that is the system that was implemented initially in Germany after World War II, a country that had been victim of hyper-party fragmentation leading to the tragedy of the Shoah or the Holocaust and Hitler's takeover. But after World War II, they implemented a system that achieved that sweet spot of a number of parties that was neither too many nor too few. So you're absolutely right. The reason I take my readers on a world tour is to show them the very dangers you've just described. There are profoundly dysfunctional and problematic parliamentary systems, just like there are profoundly dysfunctional and problematic majoritarian systems. So what we have to do is calibrate democracy to get the Goldilocks principle with the right number of parties and then empower those parties so we have real competition benefiting voters.
And yet, as I mentioned earlier, most Americans want the person who gets the most votes, the person who represents the largest majority, to win. And let's take Germany. In 3 out of 4 of the past elections, no party in Germany got more than 40% support. In fact, the current prime minister in Germany received, I think, less than 26% support of voters. So wouldn't this be taking us in the direction of what Americans don't want?
Quite the contrary. I believe that it would give Americans what they really do want, but obviously Americans need to learn how other democratic systems work. The fact that a party gets less than a majority in a parliamentary system doesn't mean that system is failing. Imagine the difference between a campaign in which, rather than denigrating the opposition and saying, that anybody who believes what the other side is saying is either lacking basic intelligence or is evil. Imagine a campaign where the only way you can win is to convey to your constituents, I can work with other parties to form a government. I can work with other parties whose members might not look at the world exactly the way we do, but we have a joint enterprise of democratic governance, and it is vital that we form a coalition to govern together. Imagine that world and compare it to the one we're in, and then ask whether you think people would be happier in this world or that one. I'll tell you one thing I'm sure of. If you asked voters in systems that have the kind of system I'm describing, if they would trade it for the system we have, there would be no takers.
So how does this, I want to go through some of the issues that I personally think are the biggest problem with our current system of elections. Number one is that we are now in a position in which we are not a representative democracy. In other words, because every state has two senators, regardless of the population, it means someone living in Idaho has much more power than anybody who lives in Texas, Florida, California, etc. The other problem is that because our system is so open to manipulation through gerrymandering and other things, it has become possible for a pretty extreme portion of the country. In other words, many of the laws happening right now or not happening are the result of views that don't represent the majority of Americans. Most Americans strongly support reproductive rights, for example, and access to abortion. That's not what's happening in the Congress. So we can't say we're a representative democracy. How does this system fix that?
So I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the best example, and I give it in the book, if you compare Wyoming to California, right? A Wyoming voter has 67 times the voting power of somebody in California. In fact, if you add up the populations of the lowest 20 or 21 states, they equal California. And so you've got 42 seats in the Senate equal in terms of constituencies to the two senators representing the state of California. The Senate is, I think it's fair to say, the single most anti-democratic institution in any nation in the world that purports to essentially be a democracy.
Agreed. I agree.
Let's talk about gerrymandering. So the system that I have actually puts an end to future gerrymandering in the sense that the enemy of gerrymandering is proportional representation. And as a consequence, it will no longer be the case, as sadly it is now, that the truth is that our representatives are choosing their constituents, not the other way around, as a result of hyperpartisan gerrymandering. Now, that's slightly overstated to say that these elections aren't competitive. Rather, they're competitive, but only in the primary cycle. And the consequence of that is to push the centers of the two parties further and further apart. If you look at the Pew Research data, you see that since the early 90s until now, the centers of these parties, which once overlapped considerably, are now so sorted and moving further and further apart that we have this extreme dysfunction. And the question is how to achieve the results that you've identified, right? Majorities of Americans disapprove of a complete inability to tackle issues related to gun violence, a complete inability to ensure reproductive rights. They don't necessarily agree with the direction the court has gone on matters of the relationship between religion and government or other matters, including, for example, issues related to race. There is a core or center that could coalesce and achieve policies that would make voters happier, that would more closely align with their interests, but not as long as we continue a two-party system that is winner-take-all. If we allowed coalition governance, you're right, individual parties wouldn't get a majority, but that's actually the thing we're looking for, to require them to be able to form coalitions with others, to center our politics around the core of what most Americans want. It is, in fact, the pretense that a majority gets everything, or that winner takes all is consistent with majoritarianism, that undermines our capacity as a result of the fact that each side succumbs to base members who actually foist on all of us preferences or policy commitments that the majority of Americans don't actually want. And so we have to really understand how the business of democracy is conducted elsewhere in the world. And one of the reasons I wrote this book is because people can understand this. It's not difficult to understand. It's just not familiar to most American voters, but it needs to be. Because what we really all want is to leave our children and future generations a thriving democracy, which we can do. But it requires getting past this notion that we're special or immune from all the challenges that have confronted other democracies across the globe. We're not. And we can do better.
All right. So we have to take a break. But when we come back, I want to talk about who loses in the parliamentary system, because not everyone wins. And we're talking about how to elect the president. Can we do it better? Do we need to? We'll be back in just a moment to continue this conversation. This is Hear Me Out. This is Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headlee, and today we're talking about how the president gets installed in the Oval Office. Our guest today says we need to completely redesign presidential elections and make them look more like the parliamentary system. Maxwell Stearns is a professor of law at the University of Maryland. And just before we took a break, Maxwell, you were talking about how the system that you propose in your new book that came out today would actually make us closer to the representative democracy that the framers intended than we have now. But I want to put to you a thought that Michael Tomasky wrote about in a column for the New York Times, because he said that political scientists know that throughout history, those on the right end of the spectrum, the most conservative political actors, tend to band together in spite of disagreements, right? He said, the forces of the right hold together for strategic purposes while the forces of the left do not. In other words, history tends to suggest, though, the forces of the right hold together, but in America, while the right emphasizes the things they agree on, and they don't talk about the stuff they disagree on the left, they elevate disagreements. So isn't it possible that this kind of system could end up really favoring the right wing?
I don't believe it would. I'm actually quite confident it wouldn't. If we look at the sort of underneath the two parties, we probably have a natural at least four parties and maybe as many as six parties. On the Republican side, we have a general traditional conservative party. We can call that the GOP. We can call it the Republicans. There is another group, which we could call America First. At one point, it would have been Tea Party. Today, it might be MAGA. There's yet a third group, and I'll get to them in a minute, but let me just move to the other side. On the Democratic side, we have kind of a center-left traditional Democratic party, but we also have a progressive party, which much you might say a much stronger set of core ideological commitments.
Like a Bernie Sanders type of party.
Correct. And there may be lurking across these two groups something like a Libertarian Party. There may be something like a Green Party that could draw from both sides on at least some issues. So we probably naturally have in the United States between four and six parties. The GOP is a minority party, even with those two constituencies held together. And as we've seen with the speaker debacle after Kevin McCarthy stepped down, there are serious tensions that actually do threaten to divide the Republican Party, even without a change. However, in a system in which you were able to vote by party and have proportional representation, members of the GOP who eschew, who sort of reject the America First element, would be able to, everybody would be able to cast two ballots. You would have a districted representative, just like you do now, and for reasons that relate to the nature of majoritarian politics, you'd typically have two parties dominating those races. But then you'd have a separate vote by party, and the aggregate party votes by state would be used to achieve proportional representation for each state's delegation to the House of Representatives. And so what would happen is you'd be able to say, as a voter, I want the GOP to head the negotiations, but I don't want them to go with America First. I want them to join centrist Democrats, or the reverse, right? I want the Democrats to head the coalition negotiations, but I don't want them to go in a progressive direction, or I do want them to go in a progressive direction. And you get to send that more refined signal by casting your party ballot in a direction that lets those that are representing you know what your true ideological commitments are. You're no longer going to be admonished every 4 years to choose the lesser of two evils. And as a result, we're going to see those sort of unhappy marriages in these two large parties naturally break down, but not break down too much, because the scheme that I set up provides up to five parties until a majority coalition forms, the power to negotiate in favor of a majority coalition. So there's an incentive to have more parties and to vote for parties that truly represent your interests. But this system in which you're voting for a districted representative and by party, the system called mixed member proportionality, is precisely designed to avoid having either a party duopoly like we have, and also hyper-party fragmentation like some of the countries that you and I were previously discussing.
Okay, but let's go back to, you know, how this might solve some of the biggest problems in our system. And easily one of the most significant problems is that the wealthy mean more in America than the poor. Not just wealthy companies like AT&T, Comcast, Walmart, Pfizer, who continued to fund congressional leaders who supported the January 6th insurrection and have always in an outsized way influenced political outcomes, but wealthy individuals have been able to do the same. And under a parliamentary system, how would that change? It wouldn't. I mean, the wealthy people would still be able to, not directly bribe, but influence through lobbying representatives. They would still be able to put a massive amount of money into campaign ads, etc. That wouldn't change.
So there's several points to respond to here. One, of course, is that a lot of the reason why we have outsized influence by corporations goes back to a famous Supreme Court case and a highly controversial one called Citizens United.
Yes.
Not just that case. There's a body of case law that I personally think is mistaken, and I talk about some of it in the book, that has resulted in the ability of individuals or corporations to exercise outsized power. Now, I want to be clear. What I'm focusing on in this book is how to fix the problem, the crisis of our democracy. One of the things I acknowledge, and it's actually the subtitle of the book, is The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. At the end of the book, I actually say there are a lot of other problems that will remain, will continue after this is done. Here are some of them, and here are some of the proposals that I actually would support, but my initial goal is to solve the existential threat to American democracy. That's not the end of reform. It's the beginning of reform. Once we have a functional democracy, we can tackle questions like campaign finance laws. We can tackle questions like the outsized role that corporations can play by virtue of the misguided opinion, treating them as if they're flesh and blood human beings, which they are not. Because they have perpetual life, they aggregate huge amounts of capital, and they don't do so because they represent the ideological views of people who purchase their products or services. And so I think you're absolutely right to target those other problems, but I think we have to focus in a laser-like way on what the profound underlying pathology is that's giving rise to the crisis. Fix that. Acknowledge that fixing that doesn't fix everything, but at least it provides a highly functional democracy that can then take on so many other questions that our dysfunctional democracy disallows us to tackle.
So, I mean, the one question which is that I'm not asking, but is notable by its absence, is how possible you think this is. I mean, I think you and I can both agree that it's very unlikely that in our hyper-partisan state right now that we could get a constitutional amendment passed, which is what this would require. Just a reminder, a constitutional amendment requires two-thirds of both houses of Congress and two-thirds of states approving that amendment. We haven't even been able to get the Equal Rights Amendment passed, and that just says that there should be no difference in the treatment of males and females. But before we end here, I have to ask about how this plays out, especially for underrepresented minorities, because we have seen in other parliamentary systems, supposedly the way it should work in a political party is that when there is a bad actor, when there is someone who is outside the realm of civil behavior, maybe they're a white supremacist, etc., the Democrats or the Republicans could oust them. In a parliamentary system, yes, they could get ousted by one party, but we have seen in Europe that they go and start their own. There are white supremacist, nativist parties in many countries in Europe that have actually earned seats in parliament. So how would this system that you propose protect the people who are most in need of protection?
So you've raised two questions, and they're both really important, and I hope I have a chance to address them both. One is the feasibility of what I propose, and I do believe it's feasible, and I think it's really important for your audience to understand it, because I think that we make a profound mistake in this country, and that commentators are constantly making this mistake of imagining that the thing that distinguishes what is and isn't feasible is amending versus everything else, other kinds of proposals that don't require amending. That is a mistake. Because in fact, a lot of the proposals that don't require amending, for example, ranked choice voting, multi-member districts, at-large voting, these sorts of things, translate into unemployment acts for sitting members of the House of Representatives. If we hit an inflection point where we are going to have change and the question is which one, and by the way, a small correction, amending occurs either with a call by two-thirds of the states for a convention or two-thirds of each House of Congress, and
right,
then
yes,
ratification by three-quarters of the states.
Right.
However, if we were to have a state convention, which we've never had until now, but we could, we've actually gotten pretty close a couple of times, as far away as just one or two states, so we could have it. The amendment proposals could be regarded as a serious threat to the continued empowerment of folks in the Senate and in the House. And at that point, what I'm proposing becomes a vital pressure release valve that members of both houses of Congress can put forward, claim to be saving our democracy, which, by the way, they would be, and keep their jobs. So I think, in fact, that this is quite feasible. Do I think it's necessarily going to happen in some predictable calendar? No. I don't know when that inflection point hits, but I am. This is not something that's a fantasy. Other nations around the globe have changed their electoral systems, and so can we. And especially if the alternatives are a greater threat to those who hold political power than this, which A, solves the problem, ends the crisis, and B, for that very reason, it gives them additional powers, it safeguards against greater threats than other proposals might carry, and therefore it is in fact achievable. Now, as far as underrepresented groups, actually, the thing that you're describing as a bug is a feature. Imagine this. Imagine if an extremist wing of a party didn't have control over one party in a two-party system, but splintered off. You are right that in European parliamentary systems, we have fascist or neo-fascist splintered off parties. That's better. Right? They get some seats, but they don't get to roll over the entire democracy, at least in those nations that properly calibrate their systems to have more than two parties, but not too many. We have to avoid those twin dangers. Those are the twin dangers that run the risk of a fascist party taking over. A fascist party can take over a single party in a two-party system and then actually win, or it can get what's referred to as a plurality of seats in a hyper-fractured system, meaning more seats than any other party, but not a majority, and then begin rolling over the other parties, which helps to explain tragically what happened in Nazi Germany. So we have to achieve that sweet spot Goldilocks principle. We need more parties, but not too many more parties, right? Not too many, not too few. And the goal is to have deeply problematic parties splinter off because that reduces their chance of taking control.
You're very persuasive. I gotta say, I think this has only happened once before, but I might be convinced. I might be convinced by that argument.
Well, thank you. This matters. I've spent 4 years on this doing virtually nothing else. Oh, I have a day job. I teach and I write. But this book matters. And the reason I wrote it is because there are just so many proposals that are misguided. And what I'm proposing really will fix the crisis we are facing.
We want to hear from you. We don't just want to hear from you on this. We really need to. I'm not kidding when I say that the team here at Hear Me Out wants to encourage this conversation and encourage people to talk about constitutional reform and changes to our electoral process in a serious way. So we want to hear your thoughts. Agree or disagree, whatever you think, we want to know about it. Our email address is hearmeout@slate.com. Lots of you are using that email address, so keep those thoughts coming. Hear Me Out is a podcast from Slate. The show is produced by Maura Curry. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations, and Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Slate Audio. I'm your host, Celeste Headley. Until next time, speak your mind, but keep it open.